As Matt just said, I'm Andy Clark. My background, I did my PhD work at Stanford with Drosophila melanogaster, so I kind of come from the model organism side of things. Worked on that for many years, then backed into human genetics, and nowadays we're working on horse, donkey, mule, hinny, opossum, Spix macaw, Florida scrub jay. The list goes on and on and on. So things have just exploded with the ease with which one can collect genomic data now, and you can tailor your question to the appropriate organism. And so my talk, like where's the keyboard, is geared to, why isn't that working? Is geared to sort of just being a pep talk. Mind you, I do love sweating the details. I think that's going to be really, you're going to enjoy getting into the details of dealing with sequence data very soon, and that's important. But what I'm mostly going to do is try to motivate. Why do we want to collect genome sequences, and what are we going to expect to learn from them? And so the plan for my roughly hour talk here is to talk briefly about how genomic data reflect past selection, a little bit about codon substitution models and how they can be used to test selection, a little bit about site frequency spectrum tests, some of the complications that you need to worry about from the very beginning with respect to dealing with site frequency based tests, polymorphism and divergence based tests, extended haplotype tests, hard and soft sweeps, and patterns of interpopulation divergence. So it's a sort of a hodgepodge. I'm going to go pretty quickly, so let's sort of have the scheme of being bold and screaming out questions if you encounter anything that's just mysterious. So some of the attributes of DNA sequence data that reflect past selection are listed here. First of all, patterns of synonymous and non-synonymous variation in protein coding genes. We'll see a little bit about that and apply it. I mentioned the site frequency spectrum already. That's one of the first things you get when you get sequence data. There are a lot of the details having to do with the kinds of errors that you make when you have less than perfect sequence, and you'll see from the beginning that you'll never get perfect sequence, that dealing with error is an important issue to be concerned about, and site frequency spectrum is in particular one that gets distorted by errors. Aberrant patterns of linkage disequilibrium, exceptionally long haplotypes, patterns of polymorphism that are out of kilter with the levels of divergence between species, and then divergence between populations. That's pretty much in the same order. They just happen to be the particular attributes of the sequence that we'll go through. So this idea of looking at differences at synonymous and non-synonymous sites is particularly informative when you have multiple species. It's particularly applied in the situation where I'm comparing a particular single representative of multiple species, and I want to know, was there some difference in the sort of divergence time between those species? So when one can draw a tree of human, chimp, and mouse, and I think the very first genome-wide study for looking for selection in humans was ours in 2003 in Science. At the time, I had no idea that this would explode and be its own little kind of cottage industry of trying to infer selection in humans. I guess I should have anticipated that. But at any rate, one can actually estimate rates of divergence at non-synonymous sites, that is, changes in protein sequences that actually affect amino acid sequence, in a branch-specific way. And the particular thing that's being illustrated here is one can ask, is there a particular attribute of the non-synonymous substitution rate on the branch towards human that's different from the other branches of that tree? And one can construct formal likelihood tests and ask, is there a significant acceleration of the rate of non-synonymous change in humans? And so those two terms, DN, DS, then again, are this rate of non-synonymous substitutions per non-synonymous site and rate of synonymous substitutions per synonymous sites, those that do not change amino acid. So the parameter in these so-called codon substitution models that Rasmus Nielsen, Ziheng Yang, and a number have developed over the years is this parameter omega, and one can specify the expected pattern of substitutions of synonymous and non-synonymous sites under this model, and one of the parameters of that model is this omega, which you can then estimate. So there's some issues with calculation of DNDS that are not very informative. And again, we're starting with human chimp, count chimp as a non-model organism, I guess, here. Human and chimp genes differ in only a few nucleotides. It's only a percent or two. And so even very large genes don't have that many substitutions. So this is an issue of power. So statistical power is something that will come up again and again in your in your discussions about the kinds of tests that you can do. And a low power test means even if the null hypothesis is false, that is, even if there is selection operating, you're very unlikely to be able to reject it because you don't have enough data, basically. And so doing single gene tests, as the genes get shorter and shorter, obviously very short genes, human versus chimp comparison, you'll just never be able to reject the null hypothesis. This DNDS ratio can be spuriously large if that denominator, DS, is small. That's sort of obvious. Any test that's a ratio often has aberrant statistical properties. And so we need to be able to deal with that. So that paper was published, and it found lots of genes involved in immunity and so forth are important. And many, many other subsequent studies have come down the pike. And we see that the immune system is one of the most rampant targets of natural selection that you see, because pathogens are one of the strongest forces of selection historically in many, many genomes of many organisms, including, it turns out, insects. So a particular illustration of this method of DNDS I'd like to show you emphasizes one other point, which is don't just think of your one non-model organism. Think of the tree of the several relatives of your non-model organism. Because if you can get phylogeny-based data, multiple sequences from related species, you're that much more empowered. So Hollis Woodard and Brielle Fishman visited my lab for a couple weeks. They're students of Gene Robinson and had exome sequence, that is protein coding sequence, from a number of bees. And the question here was about the origin of sociality in bees. Now you think of all the questions that you're asking, like what are the genes that are involved in that which allowed bees to live in groups harmoniously and have specified tasks and castes and so forth. Kind of a high-level question that you wouldn't think you could make much traction on by just doing some genome sequence, but that was the hope, anyway, in this study. So lots of attributes were acquired in the process of becoming social. The wonderful thing about this is you can draw these bees on a phylogeny. There is enough sequence data to do a pretty good phylogenetic tree. And you can color code the tips of those trees red for the social ones. Apis mellifera is our well-known honeybee. And you can see that Apis mellifera and Floria are both social, eusocial, truly social bees with castes and everything. And so then you can actually make this inference that if those are both social, then maybe the common ancestor was social. But if these are solitary bees, then sociality must have sort of evolved along that lineage. That's the kind of thinking that we're doing. It turns out that sociality evolved a couple of times, apparently, if you draw it on the tree in this way. And so one can ask about rates of synonymous and non-synonymous substitutions on branches which led to sociality and branches which didn't. And I'm going to skip a couple of these just to kind of keep up the speed. So basically, one does this test, these tests on non-synonymous and synonymous rate as a formal hierarchical likelihood-based test. So you can say, what's the probability of this data under this model, where we allow for different rates on the social and solitary branches. So we're specifically estimating an omega parameter along these red branches, separate from a separate omega parameter along the black branches. So that's a model. We get a goodness of fit and all that sort of thing, a chi-square like. The null hypothesis is everybody has all the same rates all throughout. And you can do likelihood ratio tests by actually comparing the goodness of fit of those two. And that was the basic scheme for this. And it worked beautifully. Got a nice paper in PNAS out of it. And we did find a number of genes that looked like they were accelerated on the social branches. I should also mention that it's not quite as simple as I just sort of glossed over, because there are different issues about exactly how many times did sociality arise. So you need to do the test a couple of ways, a couple of times, based on these different models of when sociality arose. So just add that caveat. So this is just showing a few genes that are accelerated, most accelerated, evolving rapidly on the social lineages. That is, specifically, we reject the null hypothesis of equal rates and conclude that there's accelerated amino acid substitution on the social branches. And this is just a list of a few of the top genes, with a predominant emphasis on genes that are involved in behavior and brain function and metabolism. Now, metabolism had been seen before. Lots of aspects of honeybee metabolism is different. They're revved up, basically, compared to solitary bees. But so a number of the blue ones I'm not going to say any more about. But some of these ones that are involved in behavior, you might think, well, so social bees, they actually have to live a pretty complicated life. They have to understand how to you know, show each other where the food is, all the stuff that social bees do. And that one dunce particularly caught my attention. I almost fell off my seat, in fact, because I knew about this work that was published in 1976. It pays to read the older literature, too. Chip Quinn actually was a student with Seymour Benzer, the Nobel Prize winner. Seymour Benzer got interested in his book, Time, Memory, Love. If you haven't read that, it's a terrific kind of history of genetics and science book that Seymour Benzer wrote on his sort of thinkings that was written about him, that was sort of followed his career. And towards the end, he studied behavior. How do you do formal genetics of behavior? And Chip Quinn was one of his first students getting into this, and he devised this instrument here that was an olfaction kind of machine where the flies could go into one tube or the other. This is a model organism, sorry about that, but we'll get back to that. And so the flies could enter the tube or not, and there'd be different odorants in the tube, and if it was an odorant that they wanted to train the fly to avoid, like benzaldehyde or something, they'd have a shock, and the flies would get a shock, and they'd learn if they smell benzaldehyde, they'd get a shock. And very, very quickly, they learned to avoid that. And so this is showing, you know, with the control odorant, they stay, this is a fraction of time they stay in the start tube, it sort of doesn't change over time. But if they shock them, then they quickly learn. And then they could measure, are there genetic differences between lines that learn quickly or fail to learn or forget quickly and so forth. So there are all these learning mutants, and they were named things like turnip and rutabaga. They started out with different names of Nobel Prize winners, but they thought that was offensive. And so they honestly did that. And so dunce, you can see here, actually, you can see it's not particularly learning here, but then it very, very quickly, let me see, what's going on here? So this is, okay, so they're training it. So they when they get a shock, they leave the start tube. But then in the test here, you can see the last one over here is the test. Did they actually learn? Do they avoid it when there's not a shock? With dunce, the answer is no. And the normal ones, of course, they do remember and avoid that. So, okay, so here's a specific gene, cyclic AMP phosphodiesterase, clearly implicated in learning behavior in flies. And that's the fastest evolving, you know, sort of behavior gene in the honeybee. So, you know, we're off and running. Gene Robinson has a huge lab at the University of Illinois and is doing lots of follow-up stuff on that. So that's like one little vignette. The idea that you can do this with multiple species has hit a number of individuals. So we just did it with multiple species in that bee case, but you can do it with multiple mammals as well. And Karen Kosiol, who was a former postdoc here, expanded this test and looked at, so what are the genes that are showing accelerated rates in different parts of the mammalian tree. This one here is being just the human-specific branch. They only found 10 genes showing acceleration by their test, and one can very specifically dial into what particular genes are accelerated in what parts of that tree. So if you have a particular phylogeny that has some organisms over here with, you know, big flippers and organisms over here that have some other attribute, you can start to dial in and ask very specific questions about adaptation in those different features. And again, from Kosiol's paper, they're finding not only immunity and defense, but also sensory perception. So many genes that are involved in sensing the environment also seem to be rapidly evolving. And that's also true in insects as well as mammals, which is pretty interesting. I'm not going to go into details of this one, but this is just showing that these methods that let you get synonymous and non-synonymous rate differences also allow you to scan along each gene and ask, are there particular parts of a gene that are fast evolving? And for immunoglobulins, it's regions of those immunoglobulins that are interacting with the antigens. And so if you have a particular protein of interest that you think is interacting with the environment or with sensing or something like that, you can specifically ask, am I seeing a signature of positive selection specifically on the parts of the molecule that I think might be involved in some adaptive process? And often that's been successful. This is just one example of many. Okay, any questions at that point? DNDS kind of stuff. So you'll see lots in the literature of it going hot and cold. People sometimes don't like it and complain about the statistics of it, but it's among the more formally rigorous kinds of tests. There are lots of things that can foul it up, so you need to be careful, but there's beautiful software for it, one called PAML. I don't know if you guys are going to deal with that at all this meeting. It's in the workshop, but it's out there and pretty easy to pick up. And scales to genome-wide tests pretty well. There are other accelerated forms of it as well. Okay, site frequency spectrum. So this is in the situation where you get your genome and sequence a number of individuals within a population. So this is population genetics now, where we have variability within a population, multiple individuals within a population. And we're going to be looking at this thing here, which is you're counting up the sites that have the following property. So there'll be a SNP, a polymorphic site, where there's one copy of a derived allele, and all the rest are the sort of common allele. So it's a very rare variant where only one individual has it. That's known as a singleton. So the count of how many there are, the proportion of SNPs that are in that class, the singleton class, form this first bar here. Those are singletons. And then if there are two copies of the rarer allele and the rest are the common allele, that's a doubleton. That's the next bar over. Three copies and the rest are common. So as you move to the right, you're looking at more and more common variation. These are the rare variants, the singletons, and this is more common variation. And so what we're looking at here is a sort of a cartoon of a couple of different kinds of site frequency spectra. They should have been in different colors, but anyway. So what we're looking at is, that's not too well labeled, but what happens is there are different distortions. This gets pushed one way or the other depending on forces that are at play. So if there's purifying selection means that the new variant is deleterious, so get rid of it. So it's pushed ever rarer in frequency. So purifying selection would be like this blue bar. It would be, the variation would be pushed towards a rarer class. A sweep in progress would be like the red bar, where there's some common variant that's favored. So you see this high frequency of a derived allele. High frequency derived alleles might be a positive sweep. Heterozygote advantage is not shown here. Heterozygote advantage, we'll see in a minute, has a bump in the middle. And there are other forces that are at play on populations that also distort the site frequency spectrum. So we need to think through all of those. And some of the caveats then, some of these other factors besides selection that drive it are ascertainment bias. So if the SNPs that I'm looking at are on a microarray, and I pick the SNPs to be on that microarray for some reason, like I know that they're intermediate frequency, so I'll put them on the chip and then I test them, that's obviously not like a random sample of SNPs. There's an ascertainment bias to them. Admixture, so if they're individuals from two different populations that are combining and interbreeding, you can see you'll get rare variants from those two outside populations, and there'll be some distortions there. Population stratification, the easiest way to see this is, you imagine here's a territory I'm sampling my organisms from, and in fact, instead of that being one territory, there's sort of like a boundary between two different subpopulations that don't interbreed very much, but breed within those two subpopulations. So if I consider them as being one panmictic unit when really it's subdivided, that's a very, very common source of error. And that can be fairly subtle, so one has to be very careful about population stratification. We'll mention some ways to deal with that. And finally, various sorts of demographic history. So rapid population growth also generates excess rare variation. In fact, one of the odd things in human population genetics is the explosive, very recent growth that we've seen in our population gives a horrific distortion. There are five times more singletons than expected in human population if you take a very large sample. So huge distortions just caused by population growth. So one of the tests that's commonly used for the site frequency spectrum kind of distortion is known as the Tajima D test. And just a couple of terms, we'll be encountering these here and there. One is this term theta. Theta is 4 times n times mu. That's a sort of common population parameter where it's the population size or effective population size times the mutation rate. And in a population that's at balance between mutation and drift, the level of heterozygosity per nucleotide site is roughly equal to theta for theta small, if you're thinking about a per site basis. And we can estimate it by just counting up the number of segregating sites of all frequency classes and dividing by this sum, which is n, little n is the sample size, so it's 1 plus a half plus a third plus a fourth up to n minus 1, where whatever that is. So you can see the more segregating sites you have, the larger is theta. And theta is our sort of estimate of per nucleotide variability. So that's Watterson's theta. And that's a good parameter under a sort of strictly neutral kind of variation. Another parameter we can estimate is pi. Pi is like calculating the heterozygosity at each site. The heterozygosity is the probability that if I draw two copies, from two individuals, the probability that they're different from each other, that's the heterozygosity. And I average that across all sites, that's pi. It's just simply the average nucleotide heterozygosity. And this just shows one of the ways that you can calculate that. And Tajima's D is simply the difference between these. It's actually normalized by the standard deviation of that difference. And this is just showing that a site that's under no selection, I just stole this off the web, I'll admit, so it's actually a pretty nice slide. So you have some phylogeny to get the samples of alleles that you're looking at the right here, and mutations occur along the branches of this phylogeny. And so this particular haplotype has these mutations and this one. So this is then a sketch of the different haplotypes you get from this tree. It's a very nice kind of way to see that whole picture. And from this picture also, you can count up. Here's a doubleton, here's a singleton, here's another doubleton. So you get a site frequency spectrum as well from that tree. So those things ought to sort of relate conceptually in your mind. A tree, a collection of haplotypes, and a site frequency spectrum. And there's some particular relationship between the heterozygosity at each site that we get from this, calculated by pi, and from Watterson's theta, the number of segregating sites. And if everything's strictly neutral, that difference will be zero. If that difference tends to be negative, which means there are too many segregating sites for the level of heterozygosity, in other words, there's not enough per site heterozygosity, which happens if the site frequency spectrum is skewed towards too many rare variants, so Tajima's D is negative. Tajima's D is negative when you have purifying selection or excess population growth and so forth. So that's just one of several other tests that are basically crude overview tests of the site frequency spectrum. There are many other follow-ups to this that essentially fit the whole site frequency spectrum to a model and so forth. So that's just showing again, with purifying selection, you get this distortion of excess rare variation, Tajima's D goes negative, and you see a pattern that looks like this. This is just showing one of the other distortions of the site frequency spectrum. I just sort of came across this picture too. I thought, oh, that'd be fun to show. So this is just looking at Atlantic versus Gulf populations of sea bass, sparrow, horseshoe crab. Many organisms show relatively low migration around Florida, and so you compare the southeast Atlantic coast against the Gulf, and you'll see this kind of break, as though the populations used to be connected before the sea level lowered and Florida rose up out of the sea and isolated these two populations. And now they've been isolated and they've been diverging. And you see this in many, many of these. So if you didn't know about this, and oyster as well, if you didn't know about this and just considered this one population, all the sites that are rare in this population different from these would give this excess, these patterns, if you lump them together, would all give a strongly negative Tajima's D. I guarantee it. There'd be excess rare variation in samples like that. So drawing the tree and trying to infer, am I seeing really a single panmictic population, is an important first step before you apply these tests. Okay. Let's not go into this in more detail. This is ascertainment bias comes up in a situation where you're designing a microarray and scoring SNPs in a very large number of samples with a microarray. And let's not go there yet. So let's skip that too. One other thing that you can compare, many organisms have sex chromosomes. There are lots of very interesting things going on with sex chromosomes where the nature of the way selection operates on the sex chromosomes is different. Organisms that are XX, female, XY, male, means that mutations that occur on the X are hemizygous in males. So if they're otherwise recessive, males sort of immediately display those the effects of those mutations. And so you often see this phenomenon of faster male evolution or faster X evolution. The X chromosome tends to spend more of its time in females than males, and that has consequences. So there are many, many attributes that are of interest in contrasting the autosomal and the X chromosome. And this is just showing that in this particular, this actually is human data. If you look at autosomal and X variation, you do see this excess rare variation on the X, and so there's more purifying selection, but you also see excess derived variants on the X as well, as though there's more purifying, as though there's more sort of selective sweeps going on the X as well. So there's just lots and lots of work to do on the sex chromosomes, and I urge you to sort of think about that. Too many studies just sort of set aside the sex chromosomes and think, oh, we'll worry about that later, but there's often some very interesting work to be done there. You can also contrast these site frequency spectra stratified by different attributes of the sites. So we mentioned this DNDS test, We can sort of combine the two by asking, what about the site frequency spectrum of synonymous sites versus non-synonymous sites? So if you think about this for a second, synonymous sites are not going to be changing the amino acid sequence. There is this phenomenon of codon substitution bias, where you might expect there to be, codon bias, where you might expect there to be some weak selection operating on different silent substitutions. But for the most part, we can think of silent sites as being somewhat analogous to quasi-neutral. And so the red bar is giving the site frequency spectrum for those synonymous or silent changes. And if we look at these non-synonymous changes that probably affect the protein, and there's software that allows one to try to predict this, Polyphen is one of them, and there are a few others. They don't do that good a job, but they take a start at it. And anyway, the probably damaging mutations are like a radical amino acid change. So these are all non-synonymous changes. And you can see the non-synonymous, probably damaging ones do have this big excess of the rarest class of variation, which is consistent with our idea that if they're probably damaging, there's probably purifying selection, pushing them to ever rarer frequency classes, and that's exactly what we see. So that's the kind of test that you can come up with yourselves, just thinking about how can I combine attributes of these different tests. So this is combining a site frequency-based test with this comparison of synonymous and non-synonymous sites. Right? What about balancing selection? So the balancing selection is this situation where heterozygotes have the highest fitness, higher than the homozygous classes. There are a few classic examples of this in the literature. Probably the most well-demonstrated one is for the major histocompatibility complex in many organisms. There's excess variability and actually even excess heterozygotes compared to Hardy-Weinberg for many MHC genes. And so Ida Andres, a former postdoc in the lab, asked about the site frequency spectrum across all human genes. Sorry about the human examples, but there's just so much data there, it's sort of easiest to illustrate things there. And this sort of situation where you see this excess intermediacy of the allele frequency, if you do a scan and ask for, let's look across all genes and ask, do any genes show this sort of pattern of excess intermediate frequency? You find a few, and some of them have been very nicely confirmed in several different independent population samples, as though there really is a phenomenon going on here. And some of them show this sort of picture where this is one common haplotype. It's common across many different human populations. Here's another common haplotype, also common in many human populations. And it seems like they're all shared across all populations. This is a radically non-neutral kind of pattern. And it's consistent with the idea that, well, maybe there's some actual selective force maintaining that kind of haplotype diversity in that particular gene. And a number of groups at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig are tracking down what's going on with ERAP2, and could there be some form of positive balancing selection going on there? All right. So these methods work for not only purifying and adaptive selection, but also for this kind of positive selection. Now, another thing to think about when you consider a mutation arising in a population that's advantageous. You've all seen pictures of this. They increase in frequency. When they increase in frequency, if there's relatively little recombination around it, that mutation arrives on a particular haplotype, and the whole haplotype gets dragged up to in higher frequency. And what this might do is reduce, then, the level of diversity flanking that particular adaptive mutation. And so Kim and Stefan and many others since then have been asking about, can we detect signatures of this kind of adaptive selection that results in what we call a selective sweep, a reduction, a selective event that's so strong that it essentially removes flanking variation, resulting in this sort of trough of diversity. So these are plots of nucleotide diversity pi on this axis against just position along the genome, and we're seeing these chunks of the genome that are showing these sort of deficit of variability, as though something went on there. Now, I have to give you a little bit of warning that if you see something like that, it doesn't necessarily mean, aha, selection, there was a selective sweep, I've proven it. Because other things can do this as well. One in particular is if you simply drag a population through a bottleneck, you might think, okay, a bottleneck is a reduced population size or some increased probability that drift is occurring. You might think that very homogeneously reduces the level of diversity as you go through a bottleneck, but that's not quite true. That just by chance, some regions of the genome will just completely lose variability and others will keep more higher levels of variability. So you see little troughs of diversity like this as a natural consequence of bottlenecks as well. So it takes great care to try to disentangle what's due to a selective sweep and what's due to a bottleneck. And this is just showing an example of dragging a population by simulation through a bottleneck and actually observing patterns of this sort of reduced variability around very spiky looking regions of the genome. It's a little bit hard to imagine up front. Why would it look like that if I just had this homogeneous reduction in population? And it's just by chance. You sample from a smaller population when it's in a bottleneck, by chance you'll see these sorts of events. Let's skip that one too. So where are we for time? Ooh, we do have to keep up this kind of pace. Are we okay? Any questions at this point? All right. So I mentioned the complication of demography. So it's not only population growth, which gives you excess rare variation, but if this situation where if the population is complicated with migrants coming in, that affects it. If the population is subdivided, as I mentioned, we need to deal with that. Another thing that's actually important is if we're dealing with a population where there are relatively few founders, and then there was a sort of a relatively small population size where many individuals are related to each other. That is, if there's kinship among individuals in your sample, this close kinship, or if the way you sample is more likely to collect large numbers from one particular family unit somehow, rather than just a homogeneous random sampling. You really have to be careful there, because this kinship thing can really foul things up. And I can't remember if I have slides for these. Yeah. So these are sort of solutions for each of those three in order. So for this demographic model, what people do, and this starts to get way more complicated, although it's still feasible, and there are methods out there you can download and play with, people do different approaches to estimate actual demographic parameters. So by this I mean, what was the rate of growth in this population in the past? What was the rate of migration between populations? So there are methods for estimating both of those parameters. So typically you find like fourfold degenerate sites, sites that you believe are more neutral than the rest, fit some kind of demographic model. And the idea here is that the whole genome is going to be dragged through that demographic model. So if the whole genome has some distortion of the site frequency spectrum, you'll be able to estimate that with these kinds of model fitting procedures. And then each particular gene was dragged through that demography, plus on top of that there may have been selection operating. So that's the nature of this modeling. You fit the demographic model first to the whole genome and then ask about, am I seeing on top of that an extra distortion of the site frequency spectrum for each gene? For population substructure, there's a very commonly applied method that works pretty well, which is just you jam all of your variation just through principal components analysis. So a PCA actually provides a plot of, for each individual, you get weightings of those principal components. If the population is structured in some way, you can get a very nice graphical picture of that. You can see actual clusters, and I think I'll have some pictures of this later on. And then you use those principal components, those weightings of the principal components, in the model that's testing selection. And there'll be some applications of that later. Finally, for kinship, you actually have to estimate for each pair of individuals what is their degree of kinship. You can do this by methods that are referred to as identity by descent estimation. And then you get these estimates of IBD and kinship and get a kinship matrix across all pairs of individuals and use that in the model. All right. Boy, we better accelerate. So polymorphism and divergence tests. McDonnell-Kreitman is a very commonly applied one. This is this very cute idea that if you have two species that have been diverging, there's going to be a certain rate of change at synonymous and non-synonymous sites that are different between them. And if this gene is completely neutral, you'll get some neutral non-synonymous and synonymous variation. And then within the species, there'll be divergence along the branches within that species that will have the same relative rates of synonymous and non-synonymous divergence. That means we ought to be able to do a chi-square test, a 2x2 test, where we count up synonymous and non-synonymous differences that are differences between species and count up the sites that are polymorphic sites within species and just do a simple chi-square. That seems just like too good to be true, too simple to be true, but it's an incredibly robust test and has been very widely applied. And Anyway, that's out there. It's one that you can, you know, do on the back of an envelope if you can just count up sites. You don't need a big fancy computer program. An extension that Carlos Bustamante developed is a Poisson random field model. That counts up. So this is again for human chimp. Divergent sites at synonymous and non-synonymous positions and coding sequence. There were 34,000 synonymous and 20,000 non-synonymous. So you look at that ratio. Normally there should be about two times as many non-synonymous as synonymous if they're neutral, right? That's how many the mutations coming into the genetic code ought to have, twice as many non-synonymous. So you see there's a deficit of non-synonymous divergent sites here. If you look at SNPs within humans, there's roughly an equal number of synonymous and non-synonymous differences. And so if you do this chi-square, it's wildly significant, saying that that cell's the odd one. There's been a weeding out of a lot of the non-synonymous differences on the branches leading to human and chimp. And another way to see this is if this is sort of what's normally going on in evolution, namely a weeding out of many of these non-synonymous differences, then a lot of this segregating non-synonymous difference in human must be deleterious, right? Because we haven't weeded it out yet. It's segregating in the population, but it's destined to be removed by this action of selection. So this is a pattern that's consistent with a fairly strong case for purifying selection acting on our non-synonymous polymorphism. And the nice thing about this Poisson random field model is there's actually a model fits for each of the four terms of that McDonnell-Kreitman table that are based on neutral evolution, the molecular clock from Kimura. They're based on selection theory from Sewell Wright and so forth. And we won't go through all the details of that, but you can actually estimate parameters of those and get then likelihood ratio tests for selection based on McDonnell-Kreitman type data at a much, much more rich kind of scale, because you can estimate parameters of selection and so forth from them. So we applied that genome-wide and got lots of evidence for selection. Anyway, we can skip through that, because this is published also. Again, I should mention just the punchline was defense and immunity were among the most strongly selected genes. And you can see this is gamma is that selection parameter. There's actually a lot of signature of positive selection. This was the overwhelming signal for this class of genes as showing the strongest positive selection. But some genes in immunity do undergo purifying selection, and that's not too surprising. Some of those genes are not interacting with antigens. They don't need to be highly variable. They're just mission-critical genes in the process of immunity, and such a gene would then suffer deleterious consequences if there were mutations in that gene, and there was therefore purifying selection acting on some genes in immunity. Another class of tests that I'm just going to mention and sort of give you the hint of how it works is the Hudson-Kreitman-Aguadi test. It also is based on this idea of polymorphism and divergence, that under strict neutrality, there ought to be relationships between levels and patterns of variability within a population that relate to the rate of divergence between the two. And the basic idea of HKA test is you have a test locus, the one you want to know, is this gene under selection? And you need one or more genes that are your reference neutral loci. And that's always been kind of a bothersome thing about this test, but pick a gene that you think is neutral. And you're basically, the null hypothesis you're testing is, are these genes under the same kind of selective constraint? So if this one's neutral, the test is this one under any selection? And you estimate polymorphism for each of those genes and divergence for each of those genes. And it's basically a test of the null hypothesis that the ratio of polymorphism and divergence is the same across the two genes. This test is also very robust, works very nicely. You've seen many applications of it also in genome-wide way, and it's highly Googleable, and you can get lots of information on that test. All right, the most commonly applied tests in the human genetics literature recently, and you're seeing this more and more applied in elsewhere, are these extended haplotype tests. And the caveat here for your non-model organisms is generally this requires the highest standard of data. That is, you need high-quality, full-sequence data where you can say, if I see this long run of sequence that's the same across this individual, and this individual, I've not only been able to infer the sequence, but I can also get phasing of the haplotypes from those individuals. So the very best way to do this extended haplotype test is with phased, high-quality sequence data. You can also do it with SNP data, however. So one illustration of this that I had the great good fortune to be involved in is with a story with Drosophila pachya. and the Sunita cactus. So Sunita is a pretty interesting cactus in the Sonoran Desert. Almost nobody lives on it. Most of the other cacti, saguaro and so forth, there's a series of many different so-called cactophilic Drosophila species that live there. But Sunita is, this species, Drosophila pachy, is the only one that lives on the cactus itself. At the base of the cactus, there's another one called Drosophila metleri, but it's not, doesn't actually live on the host itself. And there's a very interesting story relating to cholesterol metabolism. So most plants actually do have a little bit of cholesterol, and flies require that cholesterol. They cannot synthesize cholesterol at all. We can. Flies can't, so they have to get it in their diet. And where it's mission critical for the fly is they use cholesterol to make ecdysone. Ecdysone is the hormone that's necessary to be able to go from the larval stage to prepariate. Okay? Yes? And so so if you have a block in this particular gene here, the flies cannot make ecdysone, and hence they stay as larvae forever. And so as if they stay as larvae forever, then they're always children, and hence this gene was called Neverland. That's the Drosophila community for you. So this was discovered in flies. This enzyme is called Neverland. And it's a particular, it catabolizes this reaction from cholesterol to 7-dehydrocholesterol. And of course, that's where Peter Pan is. Okay, you all know the story. So it turns out that Sunita cactus makes lathosterol, and lathosterol actually can be metabolized into 7-dehydrocholesterol, and they can make ecdysone. So if a bug can metabolize lathosterol instead of cholesterol, they're okay and they can make ecdysone. So then the whole story comes down to what's going on with Neverland in Drosophila pachy. Can their version of Neverland actually use lathosterol? And so many different species were sequenced in Neverland, and this is showing pachy is here somewhere. Here at the very top is pachy. And you can see here's a site, G250A, that's an A that is an alanine in pachy and a glutamic acid in all the other species. And so that's a site that says, well, maybe there was a specific substitution that was important in pachy that the other species didn't have. And so on for these other sites. They're not all quite fixed like that, but there's 5 sites that show this rather radical change in pachy compared to the others. So if you calculate DNDS along the branches, you can see there are numbers all over the place. For pachy, it's 0.23. It never gets to be very high, but that's higher than many of the other branches. And one of the problems with DNDS is if you think of that ratio has to be greater than 1, it's actually referring to the ratio across all the sites in the gene. And if it's only a couple of sites that are under selection, maybe the whole ratio isn't going to get higher than 1. Anyway, this is showing the part of the genome. Here's Neverland right here. And so this is all the segment right close to Neverland, about 100 kb that were sequenced. And here is sort of other random parts of the genome. And you can see there is pronounced reduced polymorphism in that neighborhood of Neverland. Lots of interesting polymorphism statistics that show a negative to GEMAS D. Same thing. So Hutchin-Kweitman-Aguade test is showing rather high significance for Neverland. It looks like it's undergoing selection. But the key thing I wanted to show you was this one, which is this omega statistic, which is one of those tests for was there a selective sweep. And it's showing that in this region around Neverland, this is at 100 kb, it's more complicated than you might guess. In fact, here's Neverland. One of the peaks isn't right on top of it, which could be due to selection in Neverland, right? There could be low enough recombination here that would drive that. This one's a little bit mysterious. So it could be actually, this could also be because of Neverland if there's that low recombination. So it really ups the need. We really want to know what's the nature of recombination in this region so we can interpret this. It's also formally possible that there was something else that was selected right near Neverland, so that the reduced polymorphism on Neverland is due to something else altogether. So even though it's very clear that there was there were substitutions in Neverland that allowed it to be able to use lathosterol, very careful biochemistry was done to show that, the absolute proof that selection was on Neverland itself is still a little bit thin. If we start with Neverland as the focal point and ask, what's the size of the haplotype as we go out from Neverland? They're showing a consistent haplotype. That's what these plots are meant to show. And the size of these sort of spider-gram kind of balls going out from Neverland is much, much larger than you see from any other focal point. So you do this picture with a lot of them. It's totally graphical. There's not a significance test associated with this particular diagram, but it's a very nice graphical way to show those kind of sweep events. And I should mention that this work was primarily done in the laboratory of Virginie Orgogozzo in Paris. She stumbled upon this Neverland story and really ran with it, did a beautiful story published recently in Science. So that's a case where a single gene resulted in a niche shift to this new cactus, right? It's really quite, it'll be in textbooks. Watch for it, Neverland. Okay, interpopulation divergence, and we're like about out of time. This is just, let me sort of jump to the main point here, which is, if you look at FST, the sort of degree of population subdivision for different genes, you find a number of genes that are outliers. And again, there's just such boatloads of data for human genetics. This is very easy to illustrate with the human data. Several genes that are involved in skin color, in pigmentation, show very, very strong patterns of differences in and out of Africa. And this is just showing this radical change in allele frequency going out of Africa, and then the haplotypes. So it's showing that they're exceptionally, this is sort of like that spidergram picture, but just sort of on a flattened out. And you can see this very large extended haplotypes for regions of genes, as though going out of Africa, there was a mutation that arose that said, you need more vitamin D. If you had lighter skin, you'd get more vitamin D. So let's have this mutation sweep up in frequency. And this happened for several different genes involved in skin color. It happened in different ways in Europe and Asia, very strikingly. So some genes involved in lighter skin in Europe are different from those in Asians. But again, this pattern is pronouncedly different between Africa and European. And we can see very clear patterns of selection now that are driven. The Asian one, MC1R, is very clearly a gene that was under positive selection in Asians for lightening skin, but not so in Europeans, not so much. And so this idea of capitalizing on site frequency spectrum, long haplotypes, and their geographic structure is particularly powerful. You can make inferences about geography and differential selection with different environments by combining those different methods. One last one is just simply by comparing the site frequency spectrum on two axes here, where the axes are two populations. So this is Tibet, this is Han Chinese, and so these are the rarest class. So imagine this as being like a histogram, so it's the color showing the frequency. So this is a site that's rare in Tibet and in Han Chinese. These are the common variants. So we have these sort of site frequency spectra plotted against each other as a scatter plot. And so you're looking for these exceptions, and these exceptions turn out to have very direct consequences with respect to ability for the physiology to adapt to high altitude, to low oxygen content. So EPAS1 is involved specifically in that developmental process of high blood hemoglobin, right? So again, this sort of contrast of site frequency spectra across populations, not only using FST, but actually the full site frequency spectrum, can also be highly informative. So this is just sort of saying everything again. Natural selection, if you look hard enough with full sequence data, it actually is quite abundant in natural populations. Signatures of selection arise from patterns of polymorphism and divergence. We can do tests that look for different times in the past. So these tests that are looking in particular at these haplotypes that have swept to high frequency, that's looking at a relatively recent event compared to those DNDS sorts of tests, which might be integrating information over the last, well, since species divergence, really. Positive selection is especially common for genes in immunity defense and perception. Most of the data there were from mammals, including human-chimp divergence, but we're seeing immunity and defense for sure in insects, and we even saw some genes in perception in that evolution of social insect story. Some genes that have a signature of recent selection, they also have larger allele frequency differences between populations. So if you have a structured population and can compare them, particularly if they are in different environments where there might be some sort of reasoning that you can do about specific adaptation to different environmental attributes, definitely don't ignore that. And power is an issue to always pay attention to. Ideally, you do this before you jump in and spend all the money on the experiment. Do some calculations on how much variability is there, what sample size do I need to be able to detect a given strength of selection, and if it looks promising, then you can jump in and go for it. And besides, NSF likes to see those power calculations. And a lot of times it's storytelling, but you can do some modeling, get some idea of, is there any prayer for this test having any ability to detect selection? And I think that's it, yeah. All right, any questions?
So
annotation is going to be critical for a species where if you want to make inference of protein coding genes, which in terms of going from genome sequence to making any statement about function, protein coding genes are the easiest place to start. So if you have genome sequence and you want to go down this route, it's a sort of long-term commitment to getting somewhere with the species. You'll almost certainly want to do RNA sequencing, and you want to run it through, you want to assemble them, align them to the genome, and try to annotate genes. It's very true that even going through all that, your confidence in the genes is going to be lower than for a model organism. So it's sort of that trade-off between some of the genes, a highly expressed gene, you're going to be able to do pretty well. It may be a gene that's of less interest with respect to adaptation, but yeah. No, it's a very good point. Annotation of protein coding genes is essential for those protein-based tests of selection. Yeah. In fact, that B story that was a DNDS story, the very first thing out of the box was just exome sequence. It was actually derived, I shouldn't say exome, it was transcriptome sequence. That was actually in the days when it was first done by 454, which had sufficient read length to do a pretty good de novo assembly of the transcriptomes. Now they've done boatloads of additional transcriptome sequence by RNA-seq with Illumina, and now they're doing the whole genome sequences as well. So they sort of did it backwards that way, but you can do a pretty good job. So it's the top 3,000-4,000 genes that you get by fairly deep RNA sequencing and assembly, and even if a gene is fragmentary, you can have a very good sense of what is the, you don't have to have a complete thorough knowledge of a gene with precise understanding of all the splice forms and everything. If you just have high confidence in the reading frame for at least a good portion of the gene, then you can apply those tests.
So. You've got 10 minutes for questions, great.
So when you're looking at the site frequency section, you kept saying excess of rare, not, is that purely a visual, like you look at the graph and you say, oh, I have a spike at this point, or is there a formal statistical test?
Well, so Tajima's D and Fu and Lee's F test, those are essentially looking at the site frequency spectrum. So a negative Tajima's D is, in words, equivalent with excess rare variation. Yeah, and there is a formal test for that where you get a chi-square and a p-value.
So the site frequency spectrum was just on the minor alleles, or minor?
Yeah, so you're raising a very good point, which I kind of glossed over, which is ideally, the very best situation is where you have not only your species and the polymorphism in it, but you have an outgroup or more than one outgroup so that you can determine what's the derived allele versus the ancestral allele. So the ancestral allele is the state of that SNP that's shared with the common ancestor. And then the newly arisen allele is the derived allele. And now there are situations where, of course, so that axis, the x-axis can go from zero, well, it's actually singletons is the first column, all the way up to fixation, well, one minus fixation, because it's fixed, it's not on a site frequency spectrum. But right, so a derived allele can have frequency, you know, n minus one, all but one could be the derived allele. So the commonest allele may be the derived one, if it's being swept to frequency, or some drifting alleles will as well. So that's the best. That's known as a unfolded site frequency spectrum, where you actually know what's ancestral and what's derived. That's the best case. Often you don't have that outgroup, or often, you know, the outgroup will be highly polymorphic as well, in which case you could have polymorphism that's shared all the way since, and so there'll be confounding of what's ancestral, what's derived. So sometimes what's done is the site frequency spectrum is folded. So that means that you're combining, so you look at a common and a rare variant, anytime you see a singleton and all the rest are another allele, whether that singleton has is a count of one of the derived allele or a count of n minus one of the derived allele, you still put them in that class. So it's like folded at 0.5, right? And then you're adding them up. So the folded site frequency spectrum is often what you deal with. And some of the tests specifically deal with knowing that it's a folded site frequency spectrum. It has a little bit different properties. But that's a very good essential point.
You talk about fitting demographic models to the genome data.
Yeah.
Do you worry about including genes that are under selection when you're fitting that model?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, so there are two ways that it's done. One way is to identify regions of the genome that are sort of spiked for being less likely to be selected. It's a kind of a strange operation, but it has worked reasonably well. So they'll take either introns or fourfold degenerate sites, or if there are genes that clearly have some really wacky behavior compared to the rest of the genome, they'll set those aside. That's one way. Another way is to simply not even try to do that, but just take like only fourfold degenerate sites across all proteins. And if you do that, then a gene that was under some strong selection, like it went through a sweep, if it went through a sweep, even the fourfold degenerate sites would have an odd site frequency spectrum, right? They would have been distorted. But the idea is it comes out in the wash across the whole genome. You look at, 15,000 genes, how many have been selected where there's this, obvious sweep event? It might be a dozen or whatever, or, maybe it's even 100, but out of 15,000, the idea is it comes out in the wash and you still get a pretty good estimate of the genome-wide demographic shift. Yeah. Good point, yeah.
What's your opinion about using what kind of outgroup for polarizing the data?
Yeah, so there the main issue is, sort of level of divergence. So if it's too close, the main problem that you have is there is too much what they call incomplete lineage sorting, where the common ancestor was a polymorphic species that then gave rise to this group that you're studying and this group as well. And many lineages, many like polymorphisms are in the common ancestor species as well as both your species and the one that you're using as an outgroup. So that kind of incomplete lineage sorting is a real pain. And they're developing beautiful methods to explicitly deal with it, but as a first start, it's probably not the easiest place to go. So you want something more distant than the past than that, ideally. And of course, if it's too far back, then too much has gone on, and your inferences about difference between that outgroup species and your targeted species of interest is integrating over too much evolutionary time, and you sort of lose signal that way too. What is that sweet spot in the middle? I'm afraid it varies from one organism to another, depending on a lot of factors, including not just mutation rate, but also effective population size, the nature of the sort of demographic changes that have occurred. It's sort of hard to tell. So one thing I can say is the very best always is to have more than one outgroup. If you have a whole phylogeny, a tree, where your species of interest is here, then you'll find that different genes within your target species of interest, different genes will have different optimal outgroup species for studying it. So sort of embedding its whole genome in the context of the phylogeny is the strongest approach, if you can do it.
Andy, you really liked how you helped motivate transcriptome data because of the possibility of annotation. I wonder if you could comment on if it's like in genomic data, but in non-models, we're typically not going to have extended haplotypes. But there is options for collecting data such that you can get, say, 500 base pairs of and for haplotypes as opposed to SNPs. And to what degree do you gain power in some of these tests?
Yeah. So I guess one of the better examples maybe is that Neverland story. I was a little bit more negative about sort of our inability to specifically say that the selection was acting at Neverland, but that's the gene Neverland itself. In that region, it's very clear that selection was operating, and that was based on data where we did actually make inference of haplotypes. Now that was with inbred lines of flies where we can actually, sort of get haplotypes directly. A lot of times if you can't bring an organism into a laboratory, you can't inbreed it, you just have to deal with whatever is the collection of genotypes that you happen to sample in nature. And then there are statistical methods for inference of haplotypes. And what really matters for being able to do that is the degree of linkage disequilibrium in the sample. So as soon as you just collect SNP data on a bunch of individuals, you can calculate what's the pairwise linkage disequilibrium across all the SNPs. I didn't show any pictures of this, I guess, but one can, there are various ways to depict that graphically. There are various ways to test the statistical significance of that pairwise correlation of SNP genotypes across sites that we know as linkage disequilibrium. And you're kind of hoping for the situation where there's enough linkage disequilibrium where you can make some traction and infer these haplotypes. And the reason it is so powerful is all those tests that were sort of haplotype-based, like those extended large haplotypes, they're sort of borrowing information from neighboring SNPs. So anytime you deal with one SNP at a time, the level of sequencing error, and it will always be there, your ability to call SNP genotypes for each individual SNP in a data set depends on your read depth and all kinds of read mapping, and all kinds of issues that will arise. Your idea that DNA sequence is digital and everything's going to be clean, as soon as you touch any data at all, you realize, God, is this a mess? It's really a lot of work to get high confidence in these SNP genotypes. And so there'll be this underlying level of error. And so if you're relying desperately, tightly on a single SNP's genotype, you're in a much worse situation than in the situation where you can sort of use the information across many SNPs in a region as a haplotype, where the occasional SNP error, you'll still know that it's this haplotype, and your ability to infer the estimate of the frequency of that haplotype is much better. And so those are, I guess, the main reasons. You see this sort of phenomenon of selection impacting the genome as haplotypes, like these extended haplotype tests, as well as the sort of inherent error correction that you get out of haplotype-based tests. So phase, fast phase, there are a bunch of tools that just given SNP genotype data, you'll be able to infer linkage phase of these haplotypes as well. Of course, with error, so watch out.
Let's do one last question.
Yeah, this is great. On the subject of sequencing error, how much should we worry in doing this frequency spectrum-based analyses about sequencing error?
Yeah, so think about it. So what is it going to do if you have to sequence and then you introduce errors into it? It almost always increases your rare variance, right? So what fraction of your singletons are due to sequencing error is always an issue. And tests like the Fu and Lee F test specifically deals with counts of singletons. So it's like out of all your beautiful sequence you've collected, it focuses on the one hardest thing to get, which is singleton counts. And so it's an issue. The test, like Tajima's D, doesn't only rely on singletons. It does rely on other site frequencies as well. And so there are various things that you can do to tighten up inference of that rare variation. The relationship between singletons and doubleton counts in particular is good. So your probability of making doubletons purely by sequence error is lower than singletons by quite a margin, roughly the square of the error rate. So if they're both errors and independent, so if you have a real spike in singletons and everything else looks normal, then be suspicious. Yeah. I'm sure there's a better answer than that, but I mean,
it's great. Can you point us any references that you can do with particular even child?
Well, this is textbook principles of population. you mean on the issue of error?
Yeah.
Wow.
And site frequency spectrum.
Yeah, so the site frequency spectrum is, that's sort of, gosh, it's spread over so many papers. And I think I would start with the textbooks. The error issue is going to be more where things really got tightened up. And you should all be kind of grateful to the human community as odd as it is, for doing this, for going just from next-gen sequence to coming up with the tools and platforms and procedures for really tightening up SNP confidence. So some of those papers, like the 1,000 genomes, those sorts of papers that really went through the GATK pipeline and how that works and how they infer SNPs, how they infer confidence is one. There was a paper recently published by Matt Nelson and colleagues in Science in 2012 where they sequenced in like 14,000 people, 202 genes. And there their focus really was on those singletons out of a sample of 14,000. Imagine that nightmare. So their write-up on how they inferred confidence in those singletons and really tightened up the error, that's exceptionally good. The supplemental report of that Matt Nelson paper is really a good place to go.
Thank you. Thanks, Andy.